guys.
Oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention. For the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated, please.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 10-0671, Kerry Hickman and others versus Williamson County and others from Williamson County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. Docket number 10-0687, In re Frank Kent Motor Company, doing business as Frank Kent Cadillac, which is an original proceeding. And 10-0776, Jack Edward Milner versus Vicki Ann Milner from Tarrant County and the 2nd Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between them. The arguments are being recorded, and a link to the arguments will be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court's ready to hear argument in the first case, Kerry Hickman versus Williamson County.
May it please the court, Mr. Williams will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Petitioners present three claims, each of which was live at the time of filing. Because they present three live constitutional violations at the time of filing, they have standing to pursue this action. The first claim that they make is a right to counsel claim. And we know that this claim was live because petitioners such as Mr. Hickman had to go to court in Williamson County and was asked to make decisions such as whether to plead guilty or not guilty.
I'll ask you a question real quick. Have we ever decided whether this court, as a threshold matter, has jurisdiction in a 1983 claim based on actions that allegedly happened in a criminal proceeding?
I am not aware of this court making that determination. But this court is the only appellate court, or is the court in Texas that hears 1983 appeals. The Court of Criminal Appeals never has done so, although this court has heard several 1983 appeals. Similarly, the Court of Criminal Appeals has never heard an appeal of a class action. This is a class action, so.
But you say they've never even heard a 1983 case.
They've never even heard a 1983 case, and that is because under 1983, you cannot challenge a petitioner's guilt, innocence, or the term of confinement. And so it's not a criminal law matter. It's a civil law matter. On the, again, back to the right to counsel claim. Petitioner Hickman and others were forced to go to court, and they were asked whether they would plead guilty or not guilty to a crime for which they might be imprisoned without the assistance of counsel. That is clear constitutional harm. And it's also clear that they had standing at the time of filing. And we know this because the pleadings and the docket are quite clear. This action was filed on June 12th of 2006. And Mr. Hickman and the others were not appointed counsel until after June 12th of 2006. So clearly at the time of filing, they had a live right to counsel claim. Similarly, on, for instance, the right to a public trial claim, that claim was ongoing throughout the period of this case. And that is because Williamson County had a written policy that said, we close our courts to everyone but criminal defendants. That's a clear violation of constitutional law. And because that violation was ongoing at the time of filing and at the time that the class certification motion was filed.
But how do you address the issue that today the issues have been resolved? How do you address that mootness issue?
The mootness issue is addressed through the relation back doctrine, and that's a well-established doctrine, and in our pleadings we refer repeatedly to two U.S. Supreme Court cases that are very clearly on point, and that's the Gerstein v. Pugh case and the County of Riverside v. McLaughlin case. And in both of those cases, we had pre-trial criminal defendants, which is what we have here. And we have inherently transitory claims, which is what we have here. And claims for prospective relief by criminal defendants are inherently transitory because they can be mooted out in a matter of minutes or hours.
Does that apply even though no class has yet been certified?
It does. And I can't remember at this moment whether it's in Gerstein or Riverside. I believe it's in Gerstein, footnote 11. The court says, because these are inherently transitory, a class might not be, it can't be certified before the claim becomes moot. And so the fact that we filed our class certification motion the same day that we filed our original petition means that we have standing to pursue that claim and the class action. And indeed, the class certification hearing was ongoing at the time that the respondents made their appeal. So we'd begun the class certification hearing at that time. So those claims are live. And again, that's because those two Supreme Court cases, Gerstein and Riverside, are so clearly on point. And the arguments that the government defendants made in those cases are clearly on point, and they echo the arguments that we're hearing from respondents here.
So if there were constitutional violations, and they have been resolved, then the relief is just simply don't do it again. Is that what?
In this case?
Right.
Yes, the relief here, it will be prospective relief saying that Williamson County procedures must adhere to
Constitution.
Well,
that's a question I have too, because you look at the injunctive and declaratory relief that you request in your second amended petition, and it looks like nearly all the relief you're asking for is forward-looking to help future people, other people, not your clients, but you know, folks who would be arrested and magistrated in the future. And are you seeking relief here that could actually be granted for your clients?
Well, again, that involves this relation back doctrine. And because the petitioners here, their claims are inherently transitory, and because under Section 1983, we're not challenging their convictions, we're not challenging their sentences, we're only seeking prospective relief. And again, the U.S. Supreme Court has been emphatic that because constitutional rights are enforceable in the first instance, they're not enforceable at the whim of government, when it's convenient for the government to decide, oh, now we'll give you your right to counsel?
But your answer to Justice Willett's question is no. Isn't that correct? That there is no relief that is going to pertain to your clients?
Well, one form of relief that would pertain to the clients is their ability to pursue the class action and to vindicate the rights of the class. But no, there would be no relief in terms of their individual criminal case.
I'm on the same issue. Assume you win. Okay, the criminal cases for the named plaintiffs have been finally resolved. They're over and done with. Williamson County argues that it's addressed the policies and procedures that your clients complained about. So assume you win the case, win the class action. What's the remedy that the trial court order should include? What can your clients obtain in this case?
We can obtain an injunction that says that they must follow the Constitution. And
don't
that
do
is,
it again.
What?
Don't do it again.
Don't do it again. And a declaration that their practices, such as they are illegal. And those are important because thousands of individuals go through the Williamson County courts at law every year. And so that relief is vital to their constitutional rights. And So that prospective relief is critical to those individuals. And whatever assertions that have been made through by the respondents here, that evidence is, well, I put evidence in quotes, it's not in the record. You can't introduce evidence on appeal, but just as importantly, there is well-established doctrine in the Laidlaw case from the U.S. Supreme Court, in Aladdin's Castle from the U.S. Supreme Court, that voluntary cessation of violations of constitutional rights does not moot a case out. We are still entitled to get that court ruling that those procedures are illegal, because it would be very...
What would be the effect of that ruling? What would be the practical effect to these individuals, these juveniles who were perhaps coerced to cop a plea, for lack of better words, because they didn't have counsel or weren't aware of counsel? What's going to be the result?
Well, the results for individual defendants are all prospective. It's not going to affect individuals that have made a plea. But what it will do is, if there's an injunction in this case, then future individuals could move to enforce that injunction, move for contempt.
But how is this case any different from Los Angeles v. Lyons back in 83? There was a guy who sued. He wanted to enjoin LAPD from ever using a chokehold that they had used on him, and the Supreme Court said they denied the injunction because he couldn't prove that he was likely to be subjected to the illegal chokehold again. No reason to suspect he would be arrested again in the future. And my question is about standing here when there's no reason to think the requested relief would actually remedy the current plaintiffs. Do you see my point?
I do see your point. And again, County of Riverside is directly on point. The county in Riverside said exactly that. They said, well, here are individuals, pretrial criminal defendants, who, in that case, they were looking to get a prompt probable cause determination. And the county said, well, all of these people, by the time it gotten to the Supreme Court, had their probable cause determination. So they weren't going to be subjected to that again. Lyons blocks their claim. The reason that we have a relation back doctrine is so that individuals can vindicate their rights. And what the Supreme Court said in Riverside is that Lyons isn't a problem, because we're not arguing that these individuals are going to violate the law again, or that these individuals need to violate the law in order to vindicate their rights. The reason the claim relates back is so that they can vindicate that right without having to run into the problem of possibly doing it. Graphically, you might think of it also this way. Lyons had a completed harm. He'd already been through that chokehold, and he filed after the chokehold had been made. Here, essentially, petitioners filed while the chokehold was ongoing, and so they had a claim at that time that could have been cured. At the time Mr. Heckman filed his claim, his right to counsel claim, he didn't have counsel. So if we'd have been able to get relief that day, he would have had relief.
Did they have to have standing, though, on the full claims of the putative class? There's an assertion, I suppose, that they did, that at the time of filing, there wasn't standing on all of the claims, and therefore the relation back doctrine is not applicable in this context.
Well, the petitioners, there are three claims, and all of the petitioners, except for Ms. Stemko, had standing on all of those claims at the time of filing, so they did have the full claims. There is Ms. Stemko's situation is slightly different, because she was a member of the public with a relative going to Williamson County Court at Law, and so her claim is slightly different. And what will happen when we go back to continue the class certification hearing is that there'll be a subclass of people from the public who have standing, and we know that they have standing under U.S. Supreme Court cases and cases, Texas cases like Tamanin. So there are subclasses, and that in Rule 42D is how we deal with individuals that have related but somewhat different.
Do any of the named plaintiffs have standing for each and every one of the claims?
Yes, Plaintiff Heckman had standing for each and every one of the claims. Plaintiff Newberry did, and Plaintiff Peterson did.
Let me just ask, just to clarify a little bit about the relief. You mentioned vindication, but also injunctive relief. And is it your position that Williamson County has, at this point, corrected their policies as they allege? And if you agree with that, then is the concern that in the future they may not continue that policy? In other words, they could revert back to a prior policy, or is it more to vindicate the current your clients at this point in time, or is it both?
We do not agree that they have curing the constitutional violations, but I'm not here to give evidence, and there's no evidence in the record about that. So the proper proceeding would be to remand this back for the class certification hearing and see, have things changed? So there's just no reason to assume that things have changed just because there's been some assertion in the briefing.
And so whether it did or not, it's really for the future, so to make sure that if they, even if they did, they don't report back to that.
Indeed, correct? And the relief is important both for the declaration of what is constitutional and what is not constitutional, and because it allows individuals an easier avenue to vindicate their rights in the future because there would have been an order in the first
place. Part of your complaint that goes to self-representation, is that really before us? Which of these class or putative class plaintiffs affirmatively seek to be self-represent?
The self-representation claim isn't that they affirmatively sought self-representation. It's that they were forced, without adequate and accurate information, to represent themselves. So that when Mr. Heckman appeared in the Williamson County Courts at Law and said, you know, and was asked, do you plead guilty or not guilty, he didn't have information that's required under the case law, such as the length of sentence, the aspects of the claim that had to be proved. And so his right to self-representation was being violated because he wasn't given adequate information about it, and he wasn't given adequate information about his right to counsel in the first place, so he couldn't knowingly and voluntarily waive his right to counsel such that he could invoke the right to self-representation. Again, I think that this case...
Your brief is very detailed in what happened to the named plaintiffs, but it does not mention Judge Brooks or Judge Wright, certainly not Judge Arnold, he wasn't even there, or Judge Higginbotham, his predecessor, I guess, by name. How, these are serious charges, how are they involved in any of the claims that you've made, other than who can be in the courtroom?
Certainly, and I think that there are two answers to that. First of all, by law, state law requires the judges trying criminal cases in each county adopt, and they must by state law, adopt procedures that apply to each appointment process in a criminal case. And those procedures apply to either a judge or the judge's designee, including a visiting judge. And so by state law, and that's in Article 2604, they are responsible for what the visiting judge did. In addition, what the judges haven't said is that that visiting judge was doing anything different than what the Williamson County Court at Law judges do regularly. They say...
Well, they don't have to, do they? I mean, surely the burden's not on them.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear...
The burden's on them, you think, to...
No, but our allegations, and again, if you look at the Second Amended Petition, which is the live pleading here, in, for instance, paragraphs 92 through 106, there are lots of allegations against the named judges. I'm out of time, so I'll sit down for now if there are no more questions.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Heath and Mr. Prejean will present argument for the respondents. Mr. Heath will open with the first 10 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I am here representing the respondent county court at law judges, Judge Brooks, Wright, and Arnold. Mr. Prejean represents all the other defendants. While I'm certainly willing and hopefully able to answer any questions and pursue any issues that the court wants to pursue, I thought it would be helpful to indicate what I expect to cover and what Mr. Prejean expects to cover. What I expect to talk about first is the unique issue involving my clients, the three county court law judges. Second, the issue of the absence of Supreme Court jurisdiction over criminal law matters, which we believe this is. And third, to talk generally about the plaintiff's lack of standing. Mr. Prejean will also address the standing issue and the issue of whether remand is appropriate or required. But as I said, I will certainly do my best to answer any questions and pursue any issues that the court wants.
Going to the second one first.
Yes, sir.
About jurisdiction. about whether this really involves a criminal law matter. Nobody's trying to attack a conviction here. Nobody's even trying to attack a statute, whether it's constitutional or the manner of how it's enforced. And so why doesn't this case fall within our civil jurisdiction?
You're correct, Justice Willett. It does. We're not attacking, or they are not attacking, a conviction. However, it is dealing with the actions of conducting criminal law proceedings in the court. What the relief they seek is to take the county court of law judges and by this court have an injunction saying, here's how you need to conduct criminal law proceedings in the future. Here's how you need to try criminal law cases. And I think that if you look at a recent case from the Court of Criminal Appeals, Armstrong versus State, it's one that was decided on June 22nd of this year. It's not cited in any of the briefs because it was after all that, but it's 340 Southwest 3rd, 759. And that was a challenge to a bill of cost in a criminal case. Interestingly, it involved a cost to repay the cost of
But it wasn't appointed. Framed as a 1983 action?
It was not a 1983
action. Do you disagree that our sister high court across the hall has never taken up a 1983 claim?
I do not believe that they have.
What significance do you attach to that?
The significance is that the plaintiffs, when they chose the 1983 action to challenge a criminal matter, had they been in Montana or some other state, and they cited issue or cases from many other states, they may not have had a problem. Had they been in the federal system, they may not have had a problem. But in Texas, we have a bifurcated court system, and they realize, or should have realized, from Article 5, Section 3 of the Constitution, that this court has no appellate jurisdiction over a 1983 action or any other action that deals with a criminal law matter, because the Constitution precludes that jurisdiction from this court and assigns it across the hall. And so they knew that the end of the appellate line.
So
in
the
that
Court
case,
of Criminal Appeals has jurisdiction over this, over these claims?
They have jurisdiction. They may not. let me go back just a second and correct something I said. And I believe I'm correct here. I'd have to go back and double check. I think there may have been a 1983 action that went up to the Court of Criminal Appeals, but it wasn't decided there. And, you know, I don't think they actually I don't think there was any decision on it, but I would have to double check that. But, you know, I think that I do not believe that the Court of Criminal Appeals has jurisdiction. There are some things where the appellate jurisdiction is going to stop before it gets to this court.
Which would mean, if all their allegations are true, that there is a constitutional violation that is occurring widespread, or has occurred, maybe occurring widespread, in Williamson County, and there is no relief for a violation of Constitution. Is that
not correct? Not at all, Your Honor.
Where would the relief be?
They could have, for example, in the criminal matter, they could take an appeal, a direct appeal of any conviction, and raise the denial of counsel as an element of direct appeal. They could have brought a writ of mandamus, and the Court of Criminal Appeals has authority to hear that. They could have brought a writ of habeas corpus. There are vehicles for doing that. 1983 may not be the appropriate one, or at least in this jurisdiction, at least if they want to get to the Texas Supreme Court. And by the way, I'm not saying that the Court of Appeals, which has both civil and criminal jurisdiction, you know, they certainly had jurisdiction to take this case, and they did.
Why don't you hit your other two issues real quickly?
All right. In regard to the three county court of law judges, those individuals have had no contact with these individual clients or these individual plaintiffs on the cases that are at issue here. Now, there are some instances where Judge Higginbotham, Judge Arnold's predecessor, had some of these individuals come before him, and he appointed counsel for them. But there were cases that were earlier in the system, not the ones that are at issue. Similarly, Judge Brooks faced two of the plaintiffs. After the visiting judge had denied counsel, they came back, brought additional information, and she granted counsel and appointed counsel for both of them. One of them, shortly before the lawsuit was filed, it was like an hour and a half before the lawsuit was filed. The other the next day before she realized the lawsuit had filed. And she didn't have, none of the judges had any contact with the others, because once they were sued, once they were defendants from these plaintiffs, they recused themselves from any further contact with them. So they didn't do anything. And one of the elements of standing, and this is in Lujan, is that you have to have or be able to show the causal relationship between the claimed injury and the named defendant.
They allege unconstitutional restrictions on access to the courtroom.
Yes, Your Honor. And those, I think, are all speculative. They didn't say that anyone was denied. None of them were denied access to the court.
Was there a rule, though, that governed who could come into the court? And why would you assume that you can come in violation of a court rule?
Sure. There was apparently on the county attorney's website something that said, you know, while we're doing these arraignments, it's just the individuals, because there wasn't room in the courtroom for all the other people. They had so many people. I understand that has changed at this time, that they have made different arrangements to address that. But there's no indication, and Ms. Stemko, the elder Ms. Stemko, because I think that's the name, said she was afraid she wouldn't get in, but there's no indication that she was denied access.
There's a rule that prohibits entry. The family members facing conviction and eventual punishment, possibly, and somehow this rule, you think, didn't have the effect of keeping out interested parties.
I think if there was room in the courtroom, people could go in, is my understanding.
Was Kelsey a minor at the time?
Yes, the younger one was a minor at the time, and she has subsequently non-suited her suit. And she was appointed counsel. In fact, every single one of these individuals was appointed counsel. And I think that's the other thing that I will say just briefly in the remainder of my time.
Well, one final question about,
yes, sir,
Kelsey. When the proceedings were pending against her, she's a 17-year-old girl. Her mother wanted to attend those proceedings. And,
right,
and it sounds like you're saying there was a rule that said no, but no one really precluded her that day from going into the proceedings.
In the second amended petition, she said she was afraid she would not be able to get in. And there is no indication that she was ever denied entry.
Mr. Williams says there are at least three named plaintiffs who have standing on all three of the claims. And assuming that's true, if they have standing on each of the individual claims, why wouldn't the relation back doctrine allow them to sue, notwithstanding the subsequent mootness of those claims?
I think there are a couple of things. One is, and I think Mr. Williams indicated that in Riverside, it indicated that you could use the relation back doctrine. There is a case in this court that says, from this court, Williams versus Lahr, that says, on capable of repetition yet evading review, you may not assume that for criminal defendants. You can't assume that they're going to be recidivist. I think that this court could take a different view than the U.S. Supreme Court did on that action, if it chooses to. But the main thing is, I don't believe these individuals had standing, period. They all had counsel. They all were appointed counsel. None of them sought to represent themselves. None of these defendants, with possible exception of Ms. Stemko, and she didn't allege that it actually happened, were denied access to the courts. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. The focus of my argument will be on whether the petitioners had individual standing for injunctive and declaratory relief at the beginning of the suit. It's the respondent's position that none of the petitioners had standing for injunctive relief and prospective relief at the beginning of the suit. And on this particular point, I would ask the court to look at the nature of the Sixth Amendment claims and the relief requested by the petitioners in their petition. They were complaining about misinformation or lack of information by the county court at law judges during either the magistrate's hearing or at first appearance. They sought injunctive relief to either compel the county court at law judges to provide more information or to discontinue allegedly acts of misinformation. This all had to do with conduct at either the magistrate's hearing or at first appearance. At the time suit was filed, all of these events had already occurred with respect to the plaintiffs. They had no right to prospective declaratory injunctive relief as to those stages of the criminal process. And an important case in this
court. Help me understand this, please. I understand your argument about no standing and that there's nobody there that can be the beneficiary of whatever relief this court may grant. But what about the problem that allegedly, as you said, exists? How's that going to ever get corrected other than someone's word that there's not a problem anymore? So what's the resolution to the problem? And maybe you don't think there is one.
Well, Your Honor, if the plaintiffs have pled this case as though the lack of information or misinformation is a violation of the Sixth Amendment right in and of itself, that's the way they've pled it, and the relief that they've asked for is enjoining these judges to provide more information or the correct information or pass out the right forms during these stages. These particular plaintiffs will not face that again unless they're rearrested. And recidivism was rejected in Williams versus Lara.
I understand that, but that's not answering my question.
Once their right to counsel is actually denied, they could seek relief through mandamus.
So this is not the proper vehicle, is what you're saying. Section 1983 is not the proper vehicle for
yes, Your Honor. That is what I'm saying.
On that same point, the amicus alleges that some Texas counties are still denying the indigent defendants their rights in pretrial proceedings, and that therefore there is the potential that this type of challenge could have effects on what they claim are systemic deficiencies.
I think we need to look at the Rothgary decision. What the Rothgary decision says is that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaches at the magistrate's hearing. What the Rothgary decision does not say is how much time has to elapse between that attachment and when counsel has to be appointed. In this particular instance, no one was actually denied counsel except for a temporary period where a judge from another county temporarily denied counsel to three of the petitioners.
By temporarily, do you mean 1 week, a month? When there are different degrees, you're in jail without counsel. I think someone was in there for up to a month, right?
Well, there was a visiting judge from Travis County, and between the time of first court appearance for example, in Heckman, and when counsel was appointed, was a period of 19 days.
For Tammy Newberry, the allegation is that there was 3.5 months between the time she requested counsel and counsel was appointed. She tried to file the forms, at least the allegation is, to obtain appointed counsel and was told that they didn't accept those forms in the jail. Now, that may be subject to factual dispute, but that's the allegation.
Your Honor, my understanding of the facts is she was at the magistrate's hearing on June the 30th, and then she subsequently got counsel, I think, sometime in October. But at the time of filing suit, she had not been denied counsel. Between June the 30th and when she was joined in the suit on July the 18th. So at that point in time, the magistrate's hearing had already passed and she had not been denied counsel. So she had no individual standing as to anything to magistrate's hearing unless you assume she's going to be rearrested in the future.
So if there is a problem in this regard, you think the defendant should pursue immediate emergency relief at the time? If they wait for 19 days or 3.5 months until counsel is obtained, then they don't have a beef. They don't have any injury to complain about because they have counsel at that time. Is that part
That's
of your
correct,
argument?
Your Honor. What Rothgary, as I understand, provides is that counsel be provided before a critical stage in the judicial process. A critical stage being where the adversary proceedings of the state are brought to bear on the defendant.
Do you agree that that's at magistration?
Magistration is where the attachment of the right occurs. But what Rothgary says, to my understanding, Your Honor, is that from the time of attachment, counsel should be appointed within a reasonable time of
All
that
right,
attachment.
So if appointed counsel costs money, and if a county wanted to avoid the cost, and if they had a policy that we're going to do what we can at magistration to discourage a request for counsel, if that happened, in your view, is there any systemic judicial remedy for that? Because as I take your argument, it just isn't. The individual defendant could appeal or seek relief, but if you were looking for some other relief in the state or federal court, there just wouldn't be any.
I think there would be relief if they had standing at the time. They had actually been denied counsel at the time they filed suit, and they could show a causal relationship between the misinformation. Yes, I think they could go forward with a Section 1983 suit. What I'm saying is these plaintiffs did not have that type of standing in their suit.
Well, they didn't. Some of them did not have counsel at the time they joined the suit, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But at least so far, the U.S. Supreme Court has not said this is the given amount of time from attachment to when counsel has to be appointed. That has not been laid out.
But that's not a standing question. That's a question of whether you lose on the merits, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, in your view, they do have standing?
They don't have standing for the claims that were sought in this suit. In their claims, they're trying to restrain and enjoin the county court law judge's conduct at the magistrate's hearing or at first appearance. Those stages had already passed. The only way they would encounter those problems again, excuse me, is if they were rearrested. And in Williams versus Lyra, this court rejected the idea of recidivism as affording standing. Your Honor, Justice Willett brought up a good point about the Lyons case. The plaintiffs in this case, once those stages have passed, have no greater likelihood of harm from misinformation or lack of information at these stages than anyone else that's out there, because their chances of rearrest are equal with anyone else that's out there in the public. And this was the holding in Lyons. The motorist that had the chokehold applied to him, the court said, past acts in and of itself is not enough to confer standing. You have to show a continuing, ongoing violation. And at this point, I want to join issue with the petitioners and distinguish Gerstein and Pugh. In those cases, there was an ongoing pretrial detention with a lack of a probable cause hearing. That's to be clearly distinguished from the case that we have here.
Sorry, ongoing pretrial?
Ongoing pretrial detention. The plaintiffs in that case were clearly still incarcerated at the time, so there was an ongoing violation, as opposed to here, where the Sixth Amendment violations the petitioners are claiming had already been completed at the magistrate and first appearance stage. Your Honor, on the remand issue, Justice Patterson at the Court of Appeals had recommended that the case be remanded to explore the intervening developments that had occurred during the pendency of the appeal. And I would urge this court that there is no reason to remand. The points that were the basis for the Court of Appeals decision involved the application of law to undisputed facts, the undisputed facts being that the county did develop a new policy. It also has to do with an alternative argument that we really have not brought forward in our briefs here, and that alternative argument.
Counsel, unless the court has questions about that, your time has expired. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will hear rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to address two things. One is this question of appeal versus a 1983 case. And it is simply not the law that an individual who is not represented by counsel must go through his or her criminal case, possibly be convicted, possibly be jailed in these cases for up to a year, proceed pro se through the appellate process, all to vindicate a right that they had in the first instance, which was their right to counsel. Constitutional rights are enforceable in the first instance. They're enumerated in our Constitution because they are fundamental, and individuals have those rights, and the state...
Mr. Heath also mentioned mandamus, I thought.
And mandamus, again, there's... these are pro se individuals, by definition, because they're seeking the right to counsel. That's assuming that these pro se individuals would, A, know about the mandamus proceeding, would be able to get through those procedures, and again, they have that right in the first instance, and it does not, and even a successful mandamus on behalf of any individual wouldn't address the systemic problems that we've alleged here, so that mandamus relief or appellate relief simply isn't sufficient here.
How do you respond to the argument that since every petitioner had appeared before a magistrate by the time your client sued, and therefore your arguments don't fly? How do you respond to that?
Sure. I respond to that by looking at the Gerstein and Riverside cases again, mm-hmm. because in those cases, the question was, how quickly do you get a probable cause hearing? And the question was, do you get that within 24 hours or a week? What is sufficient? All of those individuals had their probable cause hearing well before the case got to the Supreme Court. And so the question is, at the time they filed, that's why we have the relation back doctrine, was the constitutional violation capable of being remedied by relief? Here, obviously, yes, because they did not have counsel. The right to counsel is continuous, and it's continuous for many reasons. It attaches, as counsel said, at the 1517 hearing, at the magistrate hearing. But it continues, and you have counsel for many different reasons. One of the reasons that you have counsel is so that you don't end up, as Mr. Heckman did, in front of a judge being asked, do you plead guilty or not guilty, without the advice of counsel. Also, you have counsel throughout that entire period so that counsel can do things like investigate a case, interview witnesses while the witnesses' recollections are still fresh to determine whether the state has a case in the first instance. That right to counsel, and you know, Rothgary talks about this somewhat, but Michigan v. Jackson talks about this from the U.S. Supreme Court, Maine v. Moulton talks about this from the U.S. Supreme Court, that right to counsel continues from magistration here in Texas through the conclusion of the case because counsel has a role throughout that proceeding. But regardless, we know that there were stages here where everyone, on just even a common sense view, much less the legal view, knows that you need counsel. None of us would want to face imprisonment without the assistance of experienced criminal counsel. And that's, yeah.
Let me ask you one question. The substance of this, as pointed out by opposing counsel, is that you're asking us, a civil court, to pass judgment on what inherently is a criminal matter and criminal procedure matter. Is there something that precluded, after this went through the Court of Appeals, is there something that precluded your appealing this to the Court of Criminal Appeals?
Well,
they don't have jurisdiction.
We appeal to this court because, again, the Court of Criminal Appeals doesn't hear civil cases. It doesn't hear 1983 cases.
My question was precluded from filing this appeal in the Court of Criminal Appeals. They don't have jurisdiction.
They do not have jurisdiction because it is not a criminal law matter. It is a civil matter. So the Court of Criminal Appeals would not have had jurisdiction.
It's a civil law matter because you filed it over here and as in a 1983 action. But what we're being asked to pass judgment on is certainly the criminal law procedure and process. The underlying nature of the case itself is a criminal law matter, is it not?
Well, what is before this court today is the question of standing. Do Texans have the right to go to court to inform...
Standing to complain about what?
To complain about the denial of their constitutional rights and those constitutional...
In a criminal law proceeding.
Yes, within the context of these are criminal proceedings. There's no doubt about that. But again, this court is not being asked today to rule on anything other than do Texans have the right to get into court and seek to vindicate their rights prospectively, rights that they already have? That's the question before this court. And so respectfully, I'm out of time. So respectfully, we would say that the third court was wrong, that these plaintiffs do have standing and the third court should be reversed.
Counsel, if your argument is accepted, what will preclude class defendants in criminal cases from bringing Section 1983 claims, asserting that in their criminal trial their constitutional rights were violated on any number of substantive matters?
Well, again, a 1983 action, by definition, can't challenge a sentence and can't challenge guilt or innocence.
I understand that.
Mm-hmm. So what would prevent them from intervening within an ongoing...
Something happened in my trial that violates my constitutional rights, and I want an injunction saying don't do it again. What precludes, pick a topic during a criminal trial, them witherspooning or mm-hmm. double jeopardy or something else? What precludes a 1983 class action from a criminal proceeding claiming a violation of constitutional rights coming up to our court on any number of matters if we accept your argument?
What would preclude that? Well, the question would always be prospective relief. And so if this court decides that they're standing and the case goes back and what the actual issue is in a future case deals with criminal procedure, it may be that the ultimate appeal on the merits would go to the Court of Criminal Appeals. If what the issue really is just deals with a criminal law matter, if it's dealing with guilt, innocence, or a sentence, but otherwise, this is the correct court to deal with the 1983 action. It has always dealt with 1983 actions, and the Court of Criminal Appeals does not. It does not deal with class actions.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.